and welcome into this edition of the GovChill Podcast with Rex and Lab. Happy U.S. Open Week to all who celebrate. Rex, this might be the most jam-packed major championship edition that we've ever done. Got to get into the contenders. We got to get into the pretenders. We got to get into the golf course. We got to get into the setup. But first, since we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, let's get into the news of the day. It's the reason why you're still in that very dark, that very dingy, that very depressing trailer in the TV compound because you're sticking around for the live show to break down what was a pretty significant development, I would say, as the governing bodies are still looking to roll back the golf ball. If you missed it, essentially, they are punting the issue until at least 2030, and they have now promised collaboration, the governing bodies have, that's the USGA and RNA, with the PGA Tour, with the DP World Tour, and all the tours around the world as they try to find a different and potentially better solution for the distance issue. Again, the USGA and the governing bodies have been working on this issue for about 8 years. This was supposed to be enacted
10
with the testing standards in 2028 for the elite level, 2030 for the recreational level. Now it looks, Rex, at least 2030 before we're finally going to see some potential progress on this.
I think you touched on a couple of the important ones. And since you and I are both riders, I'm going to go with the alliteration on this. It's going to be collaborative. It's going to be comprehensive, but I'm going to take it a step forward and feel like it's going to be a bit of a collapse based on where we are right now. I feel like the USGA capitulated a little bit here to continue the strained theme on the idea, because where we were in the game was they were forging ahead. In 2028, that's when the rollback was going to go into place for elite players. That would be PGA Tour players. We kind of knew they were going to kick the can to 2030. It just makes sense to do the elite players at the same time that you're going to do the amateurs. That probably makes it a little bit more clean. In my mind, that was not the news. The news was going to be that the USGA and the RNA are going to work with the other bodies involved. It's not as though they weren't working with them before. And there's been a couple of inflection points, and that's what Todd and I are going to talk about on the show tonight. One of them came 2 weeks ago at the memorial. There was a PAC meeting. There were some poly board members who were in that room. And the USGA presented a lot of the data that they had found when they came to this conclusion that this is why this was going to work. This is why the rollback golf ball, the new standard, was going to work and draw a hard line in the sand. And by and large, I've been told that pretty much every player in that room pushed back, with one of the loudest voices, I was told, being Scottie Scheffler, the world number one. And this wasn't contentious. I asked one PAC member how he would characterize that meeting, and he said eye-opening for the USGA. And I also asked this particular PAC member, do you think that led to today's decision to not only kick the can down the road to 2030, but to try to come up with something more that was going to be more comprehensive? Because by and large, players on the PGA Tour and the manufacturers will tell you that this is just a Band-Aid on a wound that can't be stopped, that this was not going to do what they thought it was going to do. The primary example here being Cameron Young. We can begin and end the conversation with that. Cameron Young started using a golf ball that would be deemed conforming under this new standard at the Wyndham Championship last year. He won that Wyndham Championship. He went on to win the Players' Championship. He went on to hit the longest drive in recorded history on the 18th hole at TPC Sawgrass. He was the most dominant player through a good stretch of the spring on the PGA Tour with a golf ball that was supposedly going to be the fix for how far players hit the golf ball. That's not the case. It's clearly not the case. So they're going to take a more holistic approach. They're going to look at the driver head. They're going to look at shaft links. I thought maybe the most telling part of the press conference with the president of the CEO of the USGA, Mike Wan, was it seems as if they're much more interested, both sides, PGA Tour, USGA, RNA, and maybe bifurcation is the answer. I know that's a lot, but this is like drinking out of a fire hose.
Yeah, that certainly was a lot. You said capitulation on the USGA's part. I would throw another word in there. I think it's an embarrassment.
It doesn't start with a C. I was doing alliteration. You didn't. Come on.
Collapse. Yeah, I get it. I do think it's embarrassing that they worked on this for a decade and are now essentially conceding. There we go. This is a concession. They are conceding, Rex. See how if we're playing along here, they're conceding that the rule that they worked basically a decade on doesn't either work or doesn't go far enough to even make meaningful or significant change. And keep in mind, that was sort of the motivation to begin with for the governing bodies, is that we have a distance issue right now where some of the classic courses are being overpowered and the game has become too one-dimensional at the elite level. But if you're looking 5-10 years down the road, if the longest drivers in the PGA Tour are hitting at 325, 330 on average,
5 to 10 years from now, are they all of a sudden going to be at 340 and 350 and some of these games cathedrals become cut down to size even more? I do think if you're a golf fan, Rex, I think you're probably relieved at this point, because another C word, we were looking at a potential game of chicken between the governing bodies and the PGA Tour.
Where if you That's what I'm talking about.
If you're looking at 2028, this is a very good partnership between you and I. A game of chicken, because if 2028 and the governing bodies were insistent and they were stubborn and we said, we're not going to acquiesce to the players, we're going to do this. And we're going to do this in the Open Championship, the U.S. Open, obviously. Augusta National was on board for the Masters. The PGA of America had sort of dipped its toes. They didn't like bifurcation. They liked the idea that everyone's playing the same equipment across all the recreational and elite levels. They did not necessarily make a firm stance one way or another, but you could have a scenario where you have a different set of equipment for regular PGA Tour events and at least three of the four major championships. And I think that would have been a nuclear option. I think that would have been terrible. I think that would have been confusing. I think that could have been a potential catastrophe for the game. Confusing and catastrophe. A couple other C words. What I think is obvious, Rex, is that this is the first time, at least, that PGA Tour players and the tour at large are acknowledging that distance is a problem and something should probably be done about it. And secondly, that this rule, as it was written and as it was intended, doesn't go far enough. That's the problem. That's the crux of the issue. And that is now why they're punting until at least 2030. I'm still a little confused. And Mike Wan did not have any answers specifically about what potential solutions they could be looking at. He did, however, stress a sense of urgency. Well, look, we've been working on this for 8 to 10 years. This is what we came up to. This is not going to be another 8-year journey. So I'm curious, what are the actual solutions that are potentially going to be bandied about that it could make the significant and the meaningful change that the governing bodies initially sought after?
We were late getting this podcast started because Jaime Diaz was sitting in this chair sort of spewing his thoughts. And I won't bore anyone with that. He is a traditionalist. He feels like there is a huge problem and that something must and has to be done. There's a lot of people in the world of golf that feel that way. The guy on the other side of that wall, Randall Chambly, is very outspoken about this. I think a lot of the players now agree that, yes, something probably needs to be done. We can't continue to head in this direction. The problem, just to clean this up, wasn't that the players don't think there's a problem and that they don't think that the USGA and the RNA should touch any of this to make sure that we find a way to draw that line in the sand. It's that everyone knew that this wasn't going to work. Cameron Young, again, being the primary example of that. If you give them a comprehensive plan, if I went on the range and asked all 156 players in the field this week that if I could wave the magic wand and say 10% off everyone fairly, equitably, Every one of them would say, yes, absolutely, perfect. Let's move forward. This draws a line in the sand. Scottie Scheffler is still going to be Scottie Scheffler, and whoever 126
they
is.
They want, let's say 10% across the board decrease. So Cameron Young, one of the longest hitters, gets 10% off, but also Brian Harman gets 10% off. You can't have a scenario where the low launch, low spin players, which is Brian Harman, Russell Henley immediately come to mind, are disadvantaged disproportionately.
JT Poston,
the longest hitters.
Brant Snedeker, three of the last five winners on the PGA Tour, by the way, we just mentioned. So there's a little.
Those guys would be crushed by this proposed rule that's now been scuttled.
Because it does not impact every player proportionally. Now, Mike Wan pushed back on that. However, I have seen the data on the other side. It doesn't. If your launch condition is A, my launch condition is B, I'm going to get penalized 12% and you're going to get penalized 2%. That's essentially what they've discovered through this different testing, because it all depends on what type of player you are. To get to your question, and it is a good question. So what can you do? If we can all acknowledge there is a problem, and I think everyone will do that, it's a multifaceted issue. That yes, we can look at this from an equipment standpoint, and then you can start with a golf ball, but let's also shrink the size of the club head from 460 cc's to 400 cc's, or whatever number makes it possible that players are no longer just able to swing from the heels every single time and know that even if I miss it a little bit, I'm still going to find the fairway. I'm still going to be somewhere where I can play it. Bring the big foul ball back into play. Shorten driver shafts. Let's go to 42-inch shafts, 41-inch shafts, whatever the case may be for the top players. And if you do that, you're going to have to bifurcate. Because once you start doing that, then it starts chipping away at what you and I do. And I'm using you and I as the royal you and I, all of us amateurs, because I don't think you want to drill down this much on the amateur game. I think, though, that's probably a starting point, because the things you can impact is, we've talked about this before, athletes on the PGA Tour and walk up and down that range, you can see it bigger, stronger, faster. You can't legislate that. That's just going to keep happening. You keep getting linebackers and power forwards and centers who now want to play golf, and they're simply going to hit it further. You can't keep them out of the gym. You can't make training better, get worse. You can't make teaching worse. You can't touch those things. So they have to focus on the things they can touch.
It is interesting. So Mike Wan, CEO of the USGA, said that they want, quote, simpler, more narrow solutions. I would argue, Rex, that the golf ball is actually probably one of the most complex and complicated parts of the equation, because they're dependent, golf balls are, in the testing. It's dependent on so many other factors of a certain player's swing. You're thinking about speed. You're thinking about launch. You're thinking about smash factor. You're thinking about spin. You're talking about aerodynamics of the golf ball. Like, that is all very, very confusing, and it differs from player to player. It's not just some baseline. Like, everyone swings wildly different. So I think if you're looking for easy, narrow solutions, to me, driver head, driver shaft length make the most sense for a narrow, more simple solution. Shrink the driver head. Put a premium on finding the center of the club face. From a driver shaft length, just
Matt Haggerty, ladies and gentlemen, first time he's been on the pod.
There he is. We've been talking about him plenty. Simply knocking down an inch or two on a driver shaft will automatically knock off 10 to 20 yards. Could you make it up for in other areas? Certainly. I think the equipment manufacturers are going, they're the best in the business. They're going to continue to innovate. They're going to continue to change. What the USGA and the governing bodies don't want is for the distance issue to continue to get even further down the line. Where I think it could potentially get messy, at least initially, is the idea of bifurcation. And as someone who has been consuming and devouring all of the college baseball content over the past month or two,
yes, like you have.
Here we go. Aluminum bats in college versus wooden bats at the pros. There's no ambiguity whatsoever. Professional golf and amateur golf are a little bit more confusing of where you would draw the line. Obviously, you would want to draw the line for professional ranks. But if you're an elite junior player, you're an elite college player, you're an elite amateur player, do you almost naturally bifurcate and play the professional equipment just to get used to it, just to prepare yourself to potentially play in qualifiers, whether Monday qualifiers or, you know, golf's longest day that you and I covered just about a week and a half ago? Is there almost a natural blending of those two just naturally? And then you and I can continue to play however long driver shaft length you and I play. We continue to play our 4 to 60cc drivers that you and I cannot hit particularly straight. So I do think there is a messy potential with bifurcation, but I also think naturally, if you're a great player, I think you still want to play what the pros play, and it might just sort of blend into junior, college, and amateur golf naturally.
No, and it shows how complex and how complicated this is, and there is no easy choice, because the alternative is, I think, what they probably faced coming out of that meeting 2 weeks ago at the Memorial, where Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour, was probably going to draw a hard line and tell the USGA and the RNA that you can make your rule change. We're not going to follow it. You refer to it. I call it the nuclear option today, because that's what it would have been. And that would have caused so much more confusion and so much more damage and so much more issues for the players than what bifurcation would have done. And maybe there's something beyond bifurcation that we can work on, because certainly when you look at tennis, and our colleague Frank Nablo has talked really well about this because he understands tennis and the history of it really well. They rolled back their ball because they felt like the game had become too one-dimensional. Just like the things we heard out of the USGA
power game
today.
Power game in tennis.
It's all about the serve. That you never saw any good volleys. I'm not a tennis fan, but I understand the concept there. You could probably do the same thing here. Getting everyone on board is going to be impossible. And the conversation this morning with Jaime Diaz was, I understand you don't want to make perfect be the enemy of good. And maybe we can get to a point that we find a good solution that's not going to be perfect, and we move forward with that, because I don't think there is a perfect solution to this.
I did not know that tennis analogy, but I think that is one that is apropos. Aaron Oberholzer, who, keep in mind, he's been on the Live From Desk now with us for more than a decade, but he was an elite player in the 90s and early 2000s going up against Tiger Woods in college. He said the easiest solution is to go back to the golf ball that we played circa 1995, and it spun a ton. The difference in what Cameron Young has put in the bag with the double dot from Titleist is that it spins less. He said, if you want to decrease distance and have more volatility and dispersion on off-center hits, just simply go to a spinnier golf ball. And all of a sudden, if you're hitting it off the toe or the heel, that is going to be wildly off the map. Again, I didn't know the tennis analogy. It was hard for me to sort of rack my brains around how golf in 2026 would be looking to go backwards in terms of equipment innovation. But if tennis is doing it, I think that's a potentially good example that they could follow.
And whatever line they draw here, and I made the equation today talking with someone on the range about this, this almost feels like drug testing, that the scientists at WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, are never going to be as good as the scientists on the other side for the athletes who are trying to find out a way. And I know it's probably not the best analogy because one of these scenarios, you have people who are cheating.
What is cheating?
I understand that. But I think it's the exact same idea because the manufacturers are smarter than the USGA. Their scientists are smarter than your scientists. And that's just the facts. And eventually, even if we implement something that does draw the line right now, whatever the standard is at the moment, we stay there for the next decade. Eventually, that line's going to get moved a little bit further because the scientists are going to figure out how to do it. The best equivalent here, what I would say, about a decade ago, they did away with the grooves, trying to reduce spin. The professionals spin the ball more now than they did when they made that decision. So it didn't work. The anchoring band. It didn't work. So I think the argument is all based on the idea that historically you have not seen the USGA make decisions that actually work. So come up with something that everyone can at least wrap their mind around and be like, yes, at least that's going to stop it right now. And a decade from now, we're going to be having this exact same conversation again.
I think we all have a couple of ideals as golf fans as we wrap up at least this portion of the podcast. And look, I think we all want to continue to go to the best venues, even if by today's standards, they are short. I'm talking about Pebble Beach. I'm talking about the old course at St. Andrews. The idea that they could potentially be overpowered by today's modern game, I think it should be really upsetting to folks. You don't want to see those sort of golf courses become obsolete. And I think all of us who love and care about the game also want to see the game not be so one-dimensional, and we want to see the importance of a center strike hit be rewarded once again. And I don't think that's necessarily true of today's modern equipment, where you literally have Roy McIlroy talked about the toe strikes and Bryson DeChambeau talking about how he's trying to increase the sweet spot on his driver so that when he does miss it, even if he's swinging 190 miles an hour, he's still hitting it long and straight. That is not what the game is. You're always going to have, Rex, players who are superior because they are longer and straighter drivers of the golf ball. What you have in this sort of drive, assuming this bomb and gouge era, is that there is not as much of a penalty for missing the fairways, and all of a sudden you can still be one of the best players in the world despite being inaccurate. So I think that's where we draw the line on that. Plenty more on golfchannel.com. If you're interested in that, we'll be sort of having it in the newsletter as well. The Live From newsletter with Rex and Lav will be going out on Thursday morning. All right. Also in that press conference at the USGA, that was John Bodenhammer, Mike Wan, and Kevin Hammer, the new president of the USGA. They also, Rex, talked about the golf course setup this week at Shinnecock. And keep in mind, the 2018 U.S. Open was the last time we had an over par winning score. Brooks Koepka winning at one over par. But those two U.S. Opens, I think most recently back in 04 and certainly in 18, were marred by controversy with the golf course, not just potentially going up to the line, but crossing it in terms of the golf course setup and being too difficult. Why that is important this week, Rex, is because we have an apoplectic Armageddon type weather forecast.
Again,
for these four rounds.
Well done.
Alliteration. Thank you very much. We're talking, Rex, about wind gusts up to 40 miles an hour potentially on Thursday, dialing it back to about 30 miles an hour on Friday, dialing it back to about 25 miles an hour on Saturday, and on Sunday, the typical winds that you see at Shinnecock, somewhere in that 15 to 20 mile an hour range. John Bodenhammer, I said on Live From earlier, he literally sounded pained as he was talking about some of the changes that the USGA is going to have to do this week in order to not have repeats of past failures and past debacles like in 04 and in 2018.
We talk so much about the idea of getting a firm and fast test. That's what you want. Those are the best tests when it comes to golf. Go look at the Open Championship. That during those years, and we haven't had one of those years in a while, that you had a lot of rain, that it looks rich, it looks green, it's lush. That's not the kind of test you want. It does seem counterintuitive that everything that John Bodenhammer is doing this week is to try to mitigate that
as best as possible. The green speeds for rounds one and two players were important this morning, and a memo from the USGA will be 10.5 on the stent meter. If that sounds familiar, that's probably what you have at your local club. That is not that fast, especially for a U.S. Open venue. We actually asked John, when's the last time a U.S. Open had greens at that speed? He knew exactly, 1995. You can go back and do the history on that one. It's the right move. We can sit here and pick it apart. We can sit here and look at the forecast. We can sit here and break down exactly what it may or may not be right with this golf course. But it's the right thing to do because this golf course is going to get away from you so quickly when you have gusts that get to that 35, 40 mile an hour range. I'll go back to the conversation I had with Ryan Gerard on Monday. He'd just come off and he'd played a practice round and he was just gushing how much he loves this golf course. And it's so cool. I wish I could just stay here and play it all the time. And I'm like, oh, so it's fair. And he goes, no, it's unplayable. 100%. It was very matter of fact. And I go, what? And he goes, look, this has nothing to do with the setup. It has nothing to do with the golf course. When the winds get to 30 miles an hour, almost every golf course in the world is going to be unplayable. At least when you talk about major championships and you start looking, and I asked John specifically, he talked about some troublesome greens is what he called them. 7 and 11 are both troublesome because they're sloped dramatically from back to front, like you would imagine. And when it's downwind, that's fine. But when it's coming into the wind, when the wind is blowing from back to front, if you're above the hole, you won't be able to stop the ball. And that's when you end up with a situation like we ended up last time. Well, Phil Mickelson apparently lost his mind and decided to swat at a putt that was moving because there was a level of frustration that the USGA is going to try to battle. They're going to try to make sure that doesn't happen this time. I think they should be applauded for at least understanding that, look, man, we can't put this on the edge because we'll lose it too quickly.
And look, I'm sure there's fans going to be like, look, the USGA has gone soft. This would have never happened in the last regime. They're catering too much to the players. They don't want the smoke and the heat like they used to. I don't think, Rex, that the golf course would be playable. Like, I don't think they can actually play golf if you had the setup like they typically would have. And keep in mind, you mentioned this, the figure of 10.5, and they hadn't been that slow since 1995. They were gunning, the USGA was, to have it about 12 on the stint meter. That was their ideal. And when you couple that with a lot of the slopes and the mounding that you have on these greens, that is lightning fast, in addition to the 15 to 20 mile gusts that you typically get. And those downwind putts are very, very scary. I was here in 2018. I'd forgotten how much I love this golf course. And I love a golf course that gets more difficult the closer that you get to the hole. And that is certainly what you have here. And then you throw in a lot of the fear-inducing elements, like the fescue and the speeds and the sloping and the wind and the runoffs. And it's just an incredible test. But I'm with you. I don't think John Bodenhammer and the USGA setup crew had any choice but to pull the levers that they're going to be pulling. And just to sort of nail down on those, the setup plan that's going to account for these conditions, that's going to involve looking at turf health and making sure the golf course is hydrated. I'm sure as you've been talking to players over the first 3 days, they mentioned how green, not just the fairways, but also the greens were, and how even soft they appeared after some early week rain as well. Just making sure that the golf course is not going to be dead earlier in the week, like we saw, I don't know, I think most famously at Chambers Bay back in 2015. Green speeds, we've already talked about that, going into mid-10s as opposed to 12. Changing some of the hole locations away from the slopes that they would have loved to target to ensure that you can actually play on Thursday. If all of a sudden you're on a 4% slope on a putting green and it's blowing 35 to 40, quite frankly, the ball is not going to stop. And then you would have had a bigger issue there with the stoppage of play. And they are going to syringe greens on Thursday and Friday. A lot of people, Rex, seem caught up on this. They're trying to douse the golf course and make it slow and make it soft. This is literally just about keeping the grass alive, preventing the wilt, preventing the stress, and being fair and consistent for both waves in the morning or afternoon. I think there's always like a visual, and fans freak out when you see the golf course setup staff out there with the big hoses and watering down the greens. Keep in mind, Shinnecock does this each and every day for member play at 2 o'clock. This is standard procedure. Again, this is unlike any golf course, I think certainly in the U.S. Open rotation. The greens are pitched, they're exposed with zero trees, and it just gets really dry really quickly. I think the USGA should be applauded by being proactive in this case, as opposed to having to sit there tomorrow afternoon and explaining how they lost the golf course again.
And the greens, everything around here is sandy soil. So the water's going to run through it quickly. It's why it's such a good golf course. It's by definition. And you're right. There will be people who will be upset saying that they capitulated to the players. I would counter and say, if we're talking about this on Sunday and the winner is at 12 or 13 under par, then fine. We can probably have a conversation.
Then they went too far in the other direction, but it's hard to imagine that with 30 miles an hour wind.
I don't see how that happens. The only way that happens is if they don't get the forecast that they have right here. And you have to take the forecast at face value. I'm sorry. That's all you can do. You can hope for the best, but if they're saying wind gusts to 40 miles an hour, you pretty much have to believe in that. And there was one light comical moment that I just cannot skip past and let go. The idea of you, and I have found out this week, Mark Rolfing sitting on the desk looking at those heat maps, which is essentially pictures of the green and anything that gets into the red, the dark red, the purple. That's where you simply can't put a pin. Anything that's white, that's an area where you can put a pin when it's real extreme like that. The look on both of your faces when they flashed that thing up on the screen and you had no idea. I don't know. Looks like it's all one blur to you. That's hilarious.
It was the 18th green. It's about 40 yards wide by 40 yards deep. And they showed the actual like pinnable location roughly being a quarter of that, like a 10 by 10 sort of square. And
because
if you
you're colorblind, I left that part out. Sorry.
Yes.
You're colorblind.
And if you had asked me to point out which part of that green that it was supposed to be showing in the heat map with the green and red was usable and what was not, I would not be able to do so. Yes, it's been a running joke for the past 3 days on live from, and I'm here for it. So again, obviously the weather is going to be a huge forecast. The setup is going to be a huge part of the story as well on Thursday. We'll be documenting on the mini pod on Thursday evening. You can rest assured. Let's talk about, Rex, some of the contenders and some of the pretenders. Who do you like this week and who do you not?
I mean, I like the normal cast of characters. We can start with Scottie Scheffler. That seems like an obvious one. I love the idea that going back a few years, he was pretty clear about what happened at Pinehurst at that U.S. Open, that he felt like he wasn't prepared. And that is not what Scottie Scheffler wants. It must have made him so uncomfortable. He might as well just come down with a case of the hives, because that, to me, is the one thing that probably drives him the most crazy, because it was such a different, unique type of test. He just wasn't ready for it. He hadn't spent the time going around the golf course making sure. He's done that this time. He's taken a scouting trip. He's been here since Sunday. I talked to Randy Smith a couple of times this week about what's been the theme. What have you been trying to accomplish? And they have covered every inch of this golf course. He will be prepared. I'm not guaranteeing him anything. There's a lot on the line this week. A win, of course, seventh player to win the career Grand Slam. But it goes beyond that. I just think this golf course is such a unique test. And he seems to be in such a good frame of mind. We know his game is there. When he's playing well, when he's clear of mind, when he's been prepared. I will say the one thing that stood out talking to Randy Smith, and you will be shocked by this, on Monday after the practice round, Scotty didn't go hit golf balls afterwards. And I asked Randy, I'm like, when's the last time that happened? And he smiled and he goes, he's happy. And I said, he's happy. And I go, when's the last time that happened on the golf course?
I do love that. I wanted to ask you, Rex, on Tuesday, because I was really struck by Scotty's comment. I think it was Doug Ferguson, our buddy at the Associated Press, who asked him about the significance of what it would mean, sort of big picture, about Scottie Scheffler to complete the career Grand Slam. And he basically said that this has never really been a motivating factor for him, and that the golf world at large just sort of moves on and the goalposts are always moving and there's more for him to accomplish. I thought that was really interesting way to look at it already, even though he hadn't necessarily achieved it. He didn't quite get to the point where he was, if you think back to Port Rush and the Open Championship last year, where he was sort of examining and wondering aloud why he cares so much about golf when it doesn't truly matter, like the grand scope of his life. But he got close, where it was emo, it was thoughtful, it was existential, Scotty. I'm just curious what you thought about his viewpoint as it relates to the career Grand Slam and that potential achievement.
I love the idea of Scotty watching what transpired over the last year with Rory McIlroy. Was that Matt Haggerty again? I love the idea that he's been watching probably pretty carefully over the last year how Rory McIlroy's arc has gone, and the idea that Rory left the Masters last year after winning the career Grand Slam. And there were a lot of emotions. There were a lot of things going on. You and I spent a lot of time talking about the idea of what's next for Rory. Where does the motivation come from? What does he have to prove? I think he probably took a lot of that to heart. Now, it's a little bit different when it comes to Scotty, because Rory had to deal with this conversation for a decade
which was a long time to actually sit and think about something that you wanted so bad. It's still relatively new for Scotty. And I think maybe a decade from now, we're probably having a different conversation. But you're right. This is Scotty at his best, sort of looking at the idea. The one thing that he said last year at the Open Championship was, you enjoy winning for 5 minutes or so. There's enough, you know, you want to be with your family. There's a celebration. But then you're kind of like, huh, I'm going to show up next week and have to do this all over again. You understand it. The grind doesn't stop. It's not as though you get to the top of the mountain. You decide, okay, I'm done. And you walk away and you go back to Dallas and you live a happy life with your family. That's not the case. So I understand where he's coming from. And it's such a unique position because, you know, the other five people who won the career Grand Slam before Rory did it last year did not deal with this because it wasn't the intensity that you have now with the media, where you are constantly bombarded with the idea that Rory won the career Grand Slam. What does this mean to him? Scotty could win it this week. What would that mean? It's tough.
It is interesting how Scotty has already come to the realization that it took Rory 3, 6, 9 months after the fact to come to grips with it. Like, oh, I'm not done here. There's still other things that I want to accomplish. Again, Scotty has not even completed the career Grand Slam, and he's already come to the realization that, yeah, it's going to be nice for a few minutes, and then I'm going to move on. I do find it, from a fan perspective, Rex, pretty fascinating, because Rory embraced the pursuit of the career Grand Slam, and he did so ever since 2014 rolled around, and he got to that point. There was a decade of him wanting it and verbalizing his intense desire to get there. And I think that really brought fans along for the ride, because then they were invested in his journey as well. And I think when you saw on that 18th green back in 2025, it resonated so far and wide, and people were so emotional in all walks of life. It's a very American story, it's a very human story, and everyone can sort of relate to that experience. Scotty has taken such a different view that I don't think it's going to have the same emotional impact, and certainly not the same societal impact. Because if Scotty is saying, yeah, it'd be nice, it's a great accomplishment, it's a dream of mine to win all four major championships, but it's not a life changer for me, I think it's really hard for the golf fan, for the sports fan, for just the general public to embrace this as well, if the person who's actually achieving it doesn't feel like it's that momentous either.
I mean, it's a very good point, and you're absolutely right. Also, Scotty is a huge, you know, believer in the process. So he's not going to allow
him. And his faith in a higher purpose and all.
Yes, and all of that. He's not going to allow himself to break out of reality and dig into this. Oh, what would it feel like walking up the 18th green? I just don't see that being Scotty. All right, if Matt Hegarty walks in here a third time, he's going to throw something at me. So I'm going to move this along. And I want to get to who maybe the favorites would be and who you don't expect to be a favorite. Before we do that, Brooks Koepka is also one of the headlines this week. Of course, he had to withdraw last week from the Canadian Open, and it was a bizarre injury. It cropped up on Saturday morning at the Canadian Open, where he starts getting therapy on the range. Essentially, it's numbness in his ring and his pinky finger. Plays awful. I actually talked with Pete Cowan, his swing coach, about this. Like, he was 90 yards right on almost every tee shot that he played for the first 6 or 7 holes on Saturday morning last year. Ended up not playing on Sunday. We now know, thanks to the reporting from our colleague Eamon Lynch, that he had some scans done both in Canada and the United States. That's all clear. It could be one of two different things. But what are the expectations now? Because coming into this event, where he would be the quasi-defending champion, he won the U.S. Open last time it was played here back in 2018. Ball striking would have been there. And he showed some life with his putter last week before he withdrew from Canada. What are your expectations for Brooks?
Pretty low. And I got into, I wouldn't say an argument, just a little back and forth with Paige McKenzie, who said, if Brooks is dealing with a nerve issue, she said he can just take a dose pack and all of a sudden he'll be fine. My counter to that was, we have ample evidence to show that he is not fine, at least the issue, where it wasn't good enough for him to play on Sunday, wasn't good enough for him to go to the golf course and play on Monday, had a limited practice session on Tuesday. He was also out on the golf course on Wednesday. And so if he wasn't feeling well enough at that point, if you know anything about nerve issues, they can be set off and they can be triggered at any point. And with this firm turf in the fairway and the turf interaction, as well as the fescue, which is 5 inches for the first cut, and I don't know, knee shin high in other spots, that can be triggered very, very quickly if he finds those sort of areas. And so if Anna teed me up and said, is it a green light if Brooks is moving forward? I said, no. I said, to me, it's yellow. To me, it's cautious. To me, it's tentative. My expectations for Brooks Koepka are very low, which I think is a bummer. I think I said it's akin to Colin Morikawa at the Players' Championship and suffered the back injury there when I think a lot of people liked his chances that week at TPC Sawgrass. Really unfortunate, really bad timing because Brooks Koepka, from a ball-striking standpoint, I think he would felt as good as anybody in the field. And as you mentioned, the putter over his past couple starts at the Nelson and then last week in Canada, we're starting to make some improvements. But having the issue that he is having with numbness and just a little bit of uncertainty in his left hand, his grip hand, his lead hand at this sort of test could certainly be problematic.
I think that's absolutely fair because he is clearly dealing with something. This isn't something that was just a one-off on Saturday and Sunday afternoon in Canada. You don't have multiple scans. Now, he did seem to be better, at least on Tuesday during his practice round. Again, Pete Cowan told me that he was better, but he was limited. He had a ball count. And anybody that's coming into this particular test, you don't want to have something else to deal with. There's already enough going on around him. So what I want you to do now, again, because if Matt Haggerty walks through that door one more time, I'm getting sculled by something. What I want you to do is pick a favorite and pick someone that you want to watch. Not necessarily that's not going to play well, because I think we've already established Brooks is your guy there. But give me your favorite and give me someone that you want to play well.
I'm going to give you five players, including one who is going to be, including one who is going to be my pick to win. The player that I want
to watch, play the game
to me is John Rahm. Based on what he did at the PGA Championship, I thought he took a lot of confidence from there, particularly after the Masters. He was a little bit down, and certainly I think sort of the skepticism and the doubt about John Rahm's major prospects seemed dim at that point. You look at his U.S. Open record has been terrific over the last couple of years, obviously won in 2021 as well. Just played well at Valderrama a couple weeks ago on the LIV circuit, so I like John Rahm. Matt Fitzpatrick is playing with Bryson DeChambeau. I like Matt Fitzpatrick this week. However, he is going to be in what should be the most difficult conditions of the day, playing in the afternoon. John Rahm as well is in that afternoon wave, but I do like his ball striking and certainly his short game and chipping and putting around the greens is very good. I like Terrell Hatton as well, who did out-duel John Rahm a couple weeks ago, as I mentioned, at Valderrama. Had a close call last year at Oakmont, the U.S. Open. There was a great quote last year with Terrell Hatton. I said it to our buddy Jason Sobel of SiriusXM. He said, I like the U.S. Open. I like my chances there because, yes, I can be a little bit mental at times. The U.S. Open and the most difficult test in golf brings everybody a little bit down to my level, so I'm not quite as disadvantaged. I like Patrick Reed, Rex, as well this week. Great scramble of the golf ball, improved ball striking year over year. I watched him and his short game coach, Josh Gregory, out on the golf course, had a conversation with him. The creativity that he can have on and around the greens, especially if this becomes a scrambling fest because everyone is missing greens in 30 to 35 mile winds, I think he becomes a very dangerous man as well. But overall, that's a long way of saying my pick to win this golf tournament, the U.S. Open in 2026, is Tommy Fleetwood. The reason why I'm picking Tommy Fleetwood is a couple reasons. I think the belief is there on this golf course. Remember, back in 2018, finished second on the strength of a Sunday 63. Had a short putt that could have been, at the time, a major championship record of 62. His form is there. A pair of top five finishes in his last four starts. And Rex, I think the fit is there in terms of Shinnecock. He's not the longest driver of the golf ball, but distance really isn't that big of a factor at this golf course. What he is incredibly accurate. I like his chances of staying out of the shin high fescue. A great piercing ball flight, which is going to be particularly important when you get some of these wind gusts, particularly if they're going to be crosswinds. Top five scrambler on the PGA Tour, has been very good inside 10 feet putting on the PGA Tour, as well as three putt avoidance, two statistics that are going to be of the utmost importance this week at Shinnecock. That's my spiel of five guys. Oof, alive.
That was a lot going on. You've been sitting on that for a minute, hadn't you?
I have. Yep.
Yeah, I could see that. All right. I like all of those things. And actually, I'm going to take it a step further as well, because now I added a third. I think you're absolutely right. It's a second shot golf course, and you have to love Tommy Fleetwood on that front. And he's playing really well. I think there's a lot of things going in his direction. And he was runner up here back in 2018 when Brooks won the U.S. Open. So there's something to be said for that. I spoke with him about this last week in Canada. The idea that now that's Jeff Fabian. Now he's going to throw something at me. Now we're really going to be in trouble. So I'll move this along quickly. The person I'm probably most interested in watching, although I'm very dubious that he's going to play well simply because it seems there's a lot going on in his life, is Bryson DeChambeau. He's such an interesting character. Putting a new driver in play, iron play is always an issue for him. As I said, this is a second shot golf course. I can imagine him
the driver not working, him hitting it all over the map, him having to play out of that hay, and him pretty much losing his mind. However, the opposite could happen. He has done this before, twice at a U.S. Open. One at Wingfoot, which was a vastly different test, but one at Pinehurst, which was a very similar test when you look at how the fairways were playing in firm and fast conditions. So I'm always entertained by Bryson DeChambeau. I think golf is at its best. Professional golf is at its best when he's playing well, because he is an interesting character. He is entertaining. And I think that's important. The winner, we already addressed this, Scottie Scheffler. I do think after a season where we have questioned a lot about his game, and he seems fractionally off. We're talking about just percentages here, just a little bit off, but we're not seeing that dominant Scottie Scheffler that we've seen in the past. I think that comes to an end this week. As I said, he has put in the time and the practice. He's comfortable here, and most importantly, he just seems happy with where he is in his game.
I've picked him to win the first two major championships of the year. I'm going to pivot for the year's third major, and of course, this will be the one that he actually wins. All right, that is going to be a wrap on this jam-packed edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. We've got you covered on any medium you could possibly want. Obviously, we're doing the podcast here, wherever it is you get your podcast. Rex and I will be on live from for the remainder of the week. He'll be on the evening shows at least the next 2 days. Plenty of coverage over on golfchannel.com. Of course, we have the live from newsletter with Rex and Lav. We're going to have an edition Wednesday night going into Thursday morning in your inboxes. We're going to have another one at the halfway point, recapping the first 36 holes of the U.S. Open. We'll, of course, have the recap that'll hit your inboxes on Monday. Make sure to go to the website, golfchannel.com/Rex and Lav, to sign up for that one. You may need to check your spam folders on Thursday morning, but nonetheless, we will have plenty of content for you. As a reminder, we'll also be back on YouTube on Thursday evening going live. Join the conversation. Jump into the comment section. We'd love to hear from you as we wrap up what should be a very, very wacky day of golf with, yes, a slowed down, watered down setup, but just some absolutely hellacious conditions that we're expecting for round one at Shinnecock. Should be a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. Enjoy the first round of the U.S. Open. We'll talk to you guys on Thursday night.
Buddy, need you to finish.